Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today, we're going to be real short in the intros because we have a packed show. At the back end of the show, there's a very special surprise, something that has not been broadcast ever before. It's a spoken word piece from Bob Avakian. I'm really hoping everyone stays tuned to hear that because I want to hear what you think about it. But the show today is all about abortion. January 22nd marks the 38th anniversary of the historic 1973 Supreme Court Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion nationwide. And that legalization meant that for the first time, women could decide whether and when they wanted to bear children. It was and is central to the emancipation of women. And that's what our show is going to be, the theme of our show today. Again, towards the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and a member of the advisory board of World Can't Wait. And we'll be talking with her about the morality of abortion and the immorality of the fight against abortion. And before that, we'll be joined by Jessica Ahrens. She's the director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress, and she also writes for rhrealitycheck.org. We'll be talking with her about the impact of the anti-abortion funding Hyde Amendment on women, especially women of color. But opening the show up is someone who I'm really pleased to have on as a guest. This is a person whose book really moved me when it came out, and I was rereading it yesterday, and I realized how important it is. Carol Jaffe. Carol's the author of Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. It's available in paperback now, and it's really something that anyone who's concerned about this and who's concerned about the oppression of women and the emancipation of women should pick this book up, and who's concerned about the role that abortion and the right to abortion plays in all that and how fundamentally important that is. Carol's book is a tremendous book, and she writes it as a war correspondent, which really I was really intrigued by. She defines herself as a war correspondent and says she's not somebody who tries to present both sides, but she's deeply embedded with the troops on the abortion-providing community side. So, Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sure. As I said, you describe yourself as a war correspondent, and you say that right off in the preface to your book, you say that cliche though it may seem, there are abortion wars raging in America. Now, that's not so, always so easy for people to see. Can you sort of tell us what you're talking about there and give us a sense of where we stand in that war?
Well, as you say, I did hesitate because it is such a cliche. I think that the front of the abortion war that most Americans probably are aware of, at least periodically, is the violence that has become associated with this field. Eight abortion providers have been assassinated, and numerous others have been stalked, harassed at their homes, harassed at their churches, not to mention their workplaces. So, I mean, that front, I think, is quite evident. But there really are numerous other fronts, the legislative, and Jessica Ahrens, of course, will tell you about the most recent congressional activity vis-a-vis the Hyde Amendment. But in the states, hundreds of regulations imposed on abortion provision, many of which are, in fact, counterproductive. And what's extremely interesting to me, and which I do go into in some length in my book, is that this war has escalated now not simply on abortion, but also to include contraception, which is a very interesting, obviously in some ways very worrisome development. But I also think actually the war on family planning might possibly be ultimately to progressives' benefit. And why I say this is that 98% of heterosexually active women at one point or another have used contraception. This is something that people do every day. This is something that women are not going to give up lightly. So it is possible that the enemies of abortion may have overreached. And just one more point, this, one of the things that will happen in the current Congress, in addition to attempts to further restrict abortion, which Jessica will tell us about, is that there's going to be an attempt to defund Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood now gets some of the contracts to distribute contraception and family planning services through the Title X program. That's the government's program to help low-income women and teenagers get birth control. This attack on Planned Parenthood is really an attack on family planning.
Well, tell me this, though, Carol, because, you know, while I agree that actually there's a link between contraception and the attacks on contraception and the attacks on abortion, You know, I do think that still this question of abortion is the cutting edge question here. And as you said, even with the popularity of contraception, frankly, abortion, the reason that they go after abortion so fiercely has very little to do with whether it's a popular sentiment or not. In fact, most people in the country actually support abortion. When you look at what's been happening, you identify in your book, you say that the state legislatures, the state rulings, you describe them as an extremely consequential front in this war. Can you talk about why and give us some examples of what you think are these very sort of the most cutting edge anti-abortion laws that have been coming out in these various states?
Well, for years there's been so-called trap laws, targeted restrictions against abortion providers. And those of your listeners who are interested in more than we can say in a short broadcast, I refer you to the website of the Center for Reproductive Rights, where they discuss this at length. Laws that really are irrelevant, widths of hallways, airflows, things that really don't really have any connection to safe abortion provision. A lot of states have imposed really egregious counseling rules that really are a breach of medical ethics. For example, even though the link between abortion and breast cancer has never been proved, in fact, the overwhelming medical consensus is there is no link, that in a number of states, abortion providers are compelled by state law to tell abortion patients that there is such a link. In other states, they're required to tell them that abortion is linked to suicide. I mean, all kinds of things that only have as their purpose to scare vulnerable women. In some states, patients are required to look at their ultrasounds, whether they wish to or not. A doctor is compelled to take them through the ultrasound to point out each part of the fetus. I mean, what purpose do these laws have other than to make abortion provision more cumbersome and for the patient herself more upsetting?
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Carol Jaffe. Carol's the author of Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. It's now out in paperback and available everywhere. Okay, Carol, one of the things that really struck me that both you talked to in your book, but I think also in terms of these laws, there's a real push, there's a development of fetal politics. There's a real push towards fetal personhood that is very, very much linked up to the drive to end abortion once and for all.
Right. In a number of states, I mean, Colorado has been the leader on this. In a number of states, there's actually been ballot measures to grant personhood essentially to an embryo, to a fertilized egg. And these are absurd. If indeed such laws would pass, and in fact, so far they haven't, all kinds of birth control would then become illegal. Anytime a woman had a miscarriage, there would be suspicion of, did she cause this miscarriage? These laws are absurd, and this is complicated. A challenge for the pro-choice movement is to show respect for the developing fetus, but at the same time not equate the moral worth of a fertilized egg with that of an adult woman. And I think we saw the absolute absurdity and cruelty of this position in a number of cases recently, but most dramatically, a case that occurred that has been occurring in Arizona for the last year or so. About a year ago, a woman who was a mother of four children, she had a very serious life-threatening illness. She came to a Catholic hospital. Now, Catholic hospitals, of course, don't provide elective abortions. Abortions are, as everybody knows, against Catholic doctrine. However, in cases of emergency, the Catholic directives on health care historically have been interpreted that you can do an abortion to save the life of a mother. But in this case, even though the nun, who was a real heroine, even though the nun who was the chief administrator of the hospital in question said, yes, go ahead and do this abortion in order to save this woman's life, therefore her four living children will have a mother, after this abortion was done at this hospital, The local bishop excommunicated the nun. He disaffiliated the hospital in question from Catholic health care. This hospital can no longer be considered a Catholic hospital. Why? Because they saved a living woman's life. And, you know, I think we're going to see these instances of fanaticism crop up more and more.
And unfortunately, I think actually the idea that it's fanaticism actually is, it's really, you know, it's tipping over into, this is certainly the way that a whole section of society, and especially the people in charge, run things. You know, you also talked about a point around the clinics. And I think this is very important because people don't realize, I think, that how much on the front lines of the abortion wars the clinics are, the clinics and the people that run them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it's exactly as you say. I mean, these people are on the front lines, and they are everyday heroes. I mean, it's become so normalized now that we have to, I think, step back and think, other than police departments, where else in America do healthcare providers go to work in bulletproof vests? Dr. George Tiller of Wichita, Kansas, who was assassinated in his church in May 2009, you know, drove to work in a armored car, you know, wore bulletproof vests almost all the time. We don't know for sure whether he was wearing one in church, but the assassin shot him in the head. Now, this, of course, is the extreme. But when you have these few extreme incidents, they set a tone for all of abortion provision. The abortion providers that I've studied over the years, deeply, deeply committed to their work. But there's no question that this kind of violence, and it's not just violence, it's harassment. A number of clinics, for example, have people outside, have everyday protesters outside their clinic bellowing into microphones, harassing the patients, screeching at them that they're going to go to hell, that the people who work there are going to hell. This takes a toll. And nobody in a civilized society should have to work under these conditions.
Well, one question I wanted to actually pose to you in relation to that, and we have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you this because, you know, it's not just, it's true, the conditions that people face in the clinics, and I want people to know that just since 1977, some statistics, 8 murders, 17 attempted murders, 41 bombings, 100 butyric acid attacks, 175 arsons, 656 alleged anthrax attacks, picketing and stalking, as you've been mentioning. And these are very, very serious things. And it adds up to me, there's a point there where you look at like the full-scale war. Anybody who doubts your assertion, your argument that there is, in fact, a war going on around abortion, I think really needs to consider what's happening at these clinics and what's happening in the state legislatures and in the general climate in society. And that's what I would ask you is that, you know, even though I know you said that, well, there's a lot of these laws don't get passed, but you make a point in your book that I thought was very important, and perhaps we'll end on this. The idea that even all these things together, there is the very real attempt to stop abortion, and nobody should be, you know, Pollyannish about that. That is real and is going on. But there's also an attempt to really sort of, they impact the culture, to change the culture in society, a culture that would from where abortion is permitted to a culture where women are actually, in fact, enslaved by the fact that they can't even control their own bodies.
Yes, I think you raise a good point. And I think this is a good way to end. I mean, besides the physical attacks on abortion, there's also cultural attacks. Speaking from the perspective of somebody who was a young adult in 1973 when abortion became legalized and observing it over time since then, you know, what is most striking to me, how abortion has become stigmatized, how it has become marginalized, from mainstream medicine, how any cultural attempts to portray it, for example, on TV, has become taboo, how you have popular movies like Juno or Knocked Up, where even the possibility of portraying abortion in a neutral light has become de facto taboo. So yes, Michael, you're absolutely right. There's also a very strong cultural front in this war against abortion.
All right, Carol, thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll have to have you back sometime in the future because I really do want to get into a whole discussion of your book, a very valuable book.
Okay, thank you. Okay. I would enjoy that.
All right, great. Thank you. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Carol Jaffe. And Carol is the author of Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with our next guest, Jessica Ahrens. Jessica is the director of Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress, and she's going to be talking with us about the impact of the Hyde Amendment on poor women, and especially women of color. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Caravan from the Balkan Brass Band. You know, this is kind of a Balkan Brass Band day. We're going to hear a little more from them in our next break as well. I kind of really find this band intriguing. I really want to hear a lot more from them. So enjoy it while we're playing it. I'm really pleased to welcome my next guest. Jessica Ahrens is the Director of Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. She also writes for rhrealitycheck.org, one of my favorite websites. And we're going to be talking with Jessica about the impact of the Hyde Amendment on women, especially women of color. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. First off, can you briefly tell people what the hell is the Hyde Amendment? Because a lot of people hear it and they have no idea what it really is.
Right. Well, the Hyde Amendment started back in the 70s, introduced by someone named Representative Henry Hyde, and it limits Medicaid funding for abortion care. So women who are enrolled in Medicaid do not have abortion covered as part of their health care plan. And since then, since it was first initiated, it has expanded to a number of other government-run programs. So now federal employees, women in the military, women who receive their health care through the Indian Health Service, and a number of other programs restrict access to abortion. They don't cover abortion in those programs. And then I can talk about this more, but unfortunately that policy has now been expanded last year in the health with the health reform law to also restrict access to private insurance coverage of abortion. And so that's coming next.
Now, you can we're going to talk a little bit more in the as we go on about the what's going on in Congress in relation to the Hyde Amendment right now. But I wanted people also to get a sense, and maybe it's somewhat obvious from what you're saying, but let's give people a sense of actually the impact of the Hyde Amendment is very, very much disproportionately felt by women, poor women, and especially women of color. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Well, the problem is that women of color are disproportionately poor in our country. That means they're more likely to be enrolled in a government-run or managed health program. And so they're more likely to feel the sting of the Hyde Amendment or similar policies. They are more likely to, and then the final piece of it is, because of socioeconomic factors, they're also subject to health disparities across the board. I mean, that can be chronic heart disease, it can be cancer, diabetes, obesity, but also within reproductive health terms, they experience a lot of disparities. They have much higher rates of unintended pregnancy, and that means they are much more likely to need an abortion. So they're going to be in a program where they can't get coverage of abortion, but they're more likely to need one. And so it's this real catch-22 that we've placed women in, poor women, and especially women of color. And it leads to all sorts of really difficult choices that people have to make between putting food on the table and raising the money for an abortion that they need, or pawning, an item like a wedding ring. There are just a lot of difficult choices that people are having to make and sacrifices that they're having to make in their lives because they don't have the resources that they need to plan for the children that they want to have and raise the children they have with the and meet their needs.
Now, I understand that another thing that people run up against when they're looking for assistance in getting, when they're trying to get an abortion under Medicaid, is they run up against a lot of bureaucrats who frankly are making it as hard as possible for women to get abortions because the fact is that there are some cases where they've made exceptions where like rape or the incest and the woman's life is in danger. They've said that those are exceptions that supposedly the Hyde Amendment won't kick in and people can get an abortion under Medicaid. But then these women are finding that there are anti-abortion bureaucrats who are making it as hard as possible to get that. Is that true?
It's both either people who have a personal bias against abortion or people who are just reluctant to do anything about the issue because it's so controversial. And then there's also just the bureaucracy that they run into. But yes, in several cases where there are exceptions in the law, even in those cases, the law is not being honored and enforced. And there's a lot of foot dragging that goes on, so that the Medicaid offices are very slow to reimburse, even in cases where they should. And to the point where many abortion providers don't even bother to become Medicaid providers because there's no point. Mm-hmm. And so even if a woman should be, you know, would under the law, you know, ought to be able to get reimbursed or be covered for the abortion care, it's not really a reality.
Mm-hmm. And plus the thing is, I think actually if a woman keeps running up against bureaucrats who are slowing down the process, there's always the very real danger that the woman may end up passing the time when a lot of people actually do abortion. So she might go into a second trimester abortion where she needs a second trimester abortion. And that's very difficult to get these days, you know, and that's another thing where women end up involuntarily being forced to have children that they actually wanted to get an abortion for, but were this delay in the bureaucracy actually forces them into a position that's really, really harmful and one that they didn't want to be in.
Yeah, I mean, the Hyde Amendment and similar policies lead to a whole host of barriers for women seeking abortion care. And it's ironic, you know, people hold a lot of conflicting views on abortion, and they don't realize sometimes how one position they hold might bump up against another. And that's exactly the point you make. Because we restrict funding and insurance coverage for abortion care, that means women are always chasing the cost of the abortion. So they're always, you know, the women who, you know, they're trying to raise money, maybe they can't tell people why they need the money because of the stigma associated with abortion, because of personal beliefs of people in their family. And so they're doing whatever they can to raise the money. And by the time they get to the clinic, the price has gone up because now they're farther along in pregnancy. And then maybe they've been pushed into the second trimester. And so by restricting, by having these anti-choice measures on the books and by restricting access to abortion, we're actually increasing the number of women who are going later in pregnancy where people feel even more discomfort about the issue.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Jessica Ahrens, Director of Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. And we're talking about the impact of the Hyde Amendment on the ability of women of color to, and poor women, to get an abortion. Now, Jessica, tell me this. What is, I understand the Hyde Amendment is actually a critical element in the Congress today, you know, that these days, you know, it's very contemporary. The assault around abortion is being concentrated up a lot around the Hyde Amendment. What's going on with the Hyde Amendment in Congress today?
Well, just yesterday, Representative Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey, introduced a bill called the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act, where he says all this bill would do is codify the Hyde Amendment. Now, let me break that down and explain what that means. To codify a law, the Hyde Amendment is something that it's part of an annual appropriations process. So when the government works out its budget to fund agencies every year, they pass appropriations bills. And the Hyde Amendment is a rider that's attached every year to one of those bills. And so it has to be reauthorized every year. So it's actually, even though it's been on the books for quite some time, it's never been permanent law. And one of the reasons that's important is because it provides those of us who support abortion rights and greater access to abortion care when it's needed to kind of challenge the Hyde Amendment from time to time and try to create more exceptions or try to get it undone. And when you make it permanent law, that makes it even harder to undo. Chris Smith says that all he wants to do with his bill is to codify the Hyde Amendment and make it permanent. However, his bill would do actually much more than that. So we have a problem just codifying the Hyde Amendment because we just think it's an unjust law that should not be made permanent, which should be repealed ultimately. But on top of codifying the Hyde Amendment, it would add back in the Stupak Amendment, which was what the big fight in health reform was about last year over abortion. It would basically make it virtually impossible to have abortion coverage within private health insurance plans in the new exchanges that are being set up right now. And it would also go into our tax code for the very first time, and it would impose tax penalties on people who pay for abortion care and people who pay for insurance plans that include abortion coverage. So it's a far-reaching bill. It's very radical and extreme. It's unprecedented in many ways, and it would expand every area that it touches on. It would expand the law, the current restrictions in the law. It wouldn't simply make them more permanent. What we already have, it would make them even bigger.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jessica, one last question. You'll have to do this in about a minute. I always like to throw that challenge out to people. The possibility that the Congress is going to try to defund Planned Parenthood and the impact that would have. Can you talk about those two things?
Sure. Our national family planning program is called Title X, and Mike Pence, another Republican, this time in Indiana, has introduced a bill that would prohibit anyone who provides abortion services from receiving that Title X family planning money. And he has talked about it explicitly as a way to defund Planned Parenthood, because the majority of what Planned Parenthood actually does is provide family planning services, counseling and information about contraceptives, pap smears, well women screenings, all sorts of services that women need and often can't get anywhere else under our current healthcare system. So Planned Parenthood's really a safety net for all of that. They actually only spend 3% of their time providing abortions, and everything else that they do is in the family planning area, and they get government money to do that, and that money already cannot be spent on abortion care. But under Mike Pence's bill, they would not be eligible to take Title X money because they use other money to provide abortion services. And so they say that it's an attack on Planned Parenthood because it's an abortion provider, but it really is an attack on family planning services and on a frontline safety net operation for women to receive health care that they can't get in the rest of our health care system right now.
Exactly, and very much part of the entire campaign against women in this society. Jessica, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. Talk to you again.
Okay.
I'm Michael Slade, and we've been talking with Jessica Ahrens, Director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress and a writer at rhrealitycheck.org. We've been talking about the impact of the Hyde Amendment on women, especially women of color. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and a member of the advisory board of The World Can't Wait, and we'll be talking about the morality of the right to abortion and the immorality of those who oppose it. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Hopla, once again from the Balkan Brass Band, a really intriguing band, as I've said before, and I'll say again. And joining us now is Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and member of the advisory board of World Can't Wait. And we're going to be talking with Sansara about the morality of abortion and the immorality of those who oppose it. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be with you.
All right. Well, let's jump into this. We've had a capsulized version in the first half hour of the show. We've had a capsulized version of and an intense one of the attacks, the situation in the abortion wars today and the attacks, where things stand. And it's a pretty dark situation in a lot of ways. And one of the things that's happened today in the world is that, and in this country in particular, is the idea that people have gotten very fuzzy about this question of morality. And there's an intense campaign to argue that abortion, that is, the way it's portrayed, is the murder of babies, is immoral and should be opposed on that, just on the care of humanity level, that it should be opposed on the basis of it being immoral. And I'd like you to speak to some of that. What is actually the moral terrain here? What are these arguments about?
Well, I think the question of morality is bound up with questions of truth as well. And I think there's both things are being distorted in what we refer to as abortion wars. First, a fetus is not a baby, and we should talk about that a little bit. But if it were a baby, we'd have to deal with that, and there would be moral questions involved in it that are different. But the fact is, a fetus is a subordinate part of a woman's body. It doesn't have an independent existence. It doesn't have an independent life. It doesn't develop unless she develops, unless she eats, unless she breathes. And she is a human being. So that's first. I think all this discussion of babies, baby killing, that's dishonest, and it's connected up with a very malicious, immoral position of forcing women to have babies that they don't want. I always say that when it comes to abortion, there's really only one moral question. Are women going to be forced to have children against their will? Are women going to be forced by patriarchal structures of the state, of the church, of society more broadly? Or are women going to be free to make their own life choices and pursue full participation in society together equally with men? And if you're going to have the latter, women have to have control over their reproduction, over birth control, over sex ed, over the right and the unstigmatized and unrestricted right to abortion. That's a moral position. Women who choose abortions, they do that because an unintended pregnancy forecloses their life plans, their options, and in this society, it is women who bear the brunt of child rearing. And it goes without saying, children are wonderful, children are beautiful, they should be parented with love, they should be cared for by society, but the idea that it's a woman's duty to bring to term every pregnancy, whether she wants it or not, and then to subordinate her life to raising that child, that's an immoral position. It's a patriarchal position, and it's one that's outmoded. So, you know, that's sort of a big answer, but it's a basic framework, and that's been lost, I think, to a lot of young women in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because did you see Randall Terry's big thing this week where he actually stood out in front of the Holocaust Museum in D.C., announced he was running for president, and had pictures of broken babies, you know, and announcing his whole campaign is going to be around anti-abortion on the basis of it is baby killing. And I was thinking that Carol Jaffe earlier said that there's a lot of focus now, in addition to what's going on around abortion, there's a lot of focus around contraception as well. And the linking of those two seems to me to have something to do with the kind of morality that the anti-abortionists and the fascists are actually trying to instill in society.
Well, I think you're exactly right, and you're also right to call them fascists. These are the driving force. As much as they like to portray themselves as pro-life, as compassionate towards babies, as concerned about women, the fact is the core of the anti-abortion movement from its inception and to today, at its core driving forces, are Christian fascists, people who believe in the absolute law of the Bible should be imposed on human beings, and the notion that women caused the fall of man in the original Adam and Eve story, and the curse that was put on us is that we have to obey our husbands and have children. That's the curse in Timothy. And the notion that women's duty is to have babies. And so what you have is there, and this has been exposed in Christina Page's book on how the pro-choice movement saved America. It's been exposed in a number of other places. But if you actually look into it, there's not a single anti-abortion organization operating in this country that upholds the right to birth control. And this is because they are not about protecting fetal life. They are about ensuring that women have children. And they are really opposed to the idea that sex could be delinked from reproduction, and they say it openly. In the pro-life encyclopedia, the pro-life handbook, the tutorial for the activists, they argue out that the first big betrayal of God's law on this question of reproduction and women and abortion was birth control, because that decoupled sex from reproduction. And right there you have a lot revealed about this has never been about fetal life. This has been about the notion that women are supposed to have children. And I think that we have to see past. There's a lot of people who are confused. There are a lot of people probably listening. There's probably pro-choice people listening. I know I'm sure that most of your listeners are pro-choice who are wincing because they're thinking, how could, you know, why don't we sound like we care about fetuses and maybe we'd get further if we try to appease. There's a lot of people who feel wishy-washy in the middle. They want the legal right to abortion, but they think it ought to be reduced. The fact is that until we get clear, there are two diametrically opposed views of society and of half of humanity. And the driving force in those who want to take away abortion are those who openly, or often not so openly, but at their core, really do want to restore biblical law. And if you don't want to compromise with that, and there's no reason to compromise with it, because the scientific fact is that a fetus is not a baby. The scientific fact is that women are human beings, and that if women aren't free to control their reproductive lives, they cannot be free. And if women are not free, then no one is free. And that's a completely moral, a completely righteous, and a completely truthful position. It's one that a lot of people are confused about, but they're not going to get unconfused unless we ourselves go out there and confront this reality and propagate it and talk to people about it and take on arguments about it. But I think you even get, if you go to the front lines of the abortion wars and you look at the front lines, those who want to restrict the right to abortion legally, those who are terrorizing the clinics on the streets, those who have shot the doctors and the nurses. And then you go on the front lines and you look at the doctors and the nurses and the providers who risk their lives every day to give women their lives back. Because without providers, there is no choice. If you look at the front lines, it becomes very clarifying. There are heroic people who are compassionate and care about women and understand how central abortion and reproductive freedom is to women's lives, and there are those who hate that and will use any form of lies, distortion, intimidation, and manipulation to confuse people about this issue, all while taking this right away from women.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking now with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, member of the advisory board of World Can't Wait, and a very, very fierce advocate of abortion rights and the emancipation of women, as everyone should be. Now, Sansara, tell me this. You know, you pointed out the thing about there's sort of been a seeding of ground based on this, both the confusion, but also the effect that the anti-abortionists and the fascists have had in terms of the culture wars and changing a whole way that society looks at abortion and the rights of women and the right of women to have abortion, how fundamental that is. And you've got this thing where a lot of people even have given up saying the word abortion, or, as you were indicating, saying that, well, abortion is a tragic thing. You know, it's sort of it's something that nobody really wants to have. And so we should actually look to, and I've read many pieces over the last week where women are talking about, abortion advocates supposedly are talking about, we want to make abortion, we want to celebrate the fact that there are fewer abortions in the country today.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about this. Well, abortion is, you know, the idea that we're a pro-choice movement, or instead of, you know, people say pro-choice or reproductive freedom or other things, avoiding the word abortion, and it's common to hear people say now, as you were drawing from, to say, oh, I'm pro-choice. Of course nobody's pro-abortion. I'm pro-choice, though. Well, I want to say I am pro-abortion. When a woman needs an abortion, it is very important that we support her in that and that we make it possible for her to get that. That's a pro-abortion position. And the fact is, we, in this country right now, because of some of the things your previous guests were talking about, parental notification laws, mandatory waiting periods, fake clinics, pregnancy crisis clinics that lure women in who are desperate and pregnant and looking for abortions and are given a guilt trip, given the runaround, given faulty medical information, and told to keep their fetus and bring their pregnancy to term. There are so many things, the intimidation on the street, at the clinic doors, the intimidation of doctors, the fact that 87% of the counties do not have abortion providers in this country. There's so many obstacles to women accessing abortion today in this country right now, not to mention around the world, that there are millions and millions of women who need abortions who are having a hard time finding them. And the fact is, if you really care about women, we need less restrictions and less stigma. And in reality, that would mean that there would end up being more abortions. There would end up being more abortions because there would be fewer women who are having children that they do not want. Now, at the same time, of course, I'm for sex education. I'm for access to birth control. I'm for access and promotion of condoms. We need much more of this. The irony, or perhaps not the irony, but the exposure, is the fact that the people who are against abortion are also against sex education. They're also against condom distribution. They're also against birth control. And so anybody who adopts the position that we want to reduce abortions, number one, we're accepting the moral paradigm, which is faulty, which is that there's something wrong with abortion, which there is not, or that there's something wrong with the women who get abortions, that they're somehow selfish. That's not true. So one, you're accepting that, which we need to reject, and two, right down on the ground, there are women today, as we speak, who are terrified, whose periods have come late, who don't know if they can tell their abusive husband, who don't know if they can tell their fundamentalist parents in southern Florida or Alabama, or forget about it, in New York or Los Angeles. People, women who are afraid, they cannot afford a child. They had life plans. They're in college. They got a chance to do something that they wanted to pursue, who need abortions, who are having an impossible time accessing it. And when you say you want fewer abortions, you are telling them that we're not going to expand this, right? And you're telling millions of other women that they could be in that position. And that's on the ground an immoral that's seeding ground, which we shouldn't, and on the ground, it's costing women the pursuit of meaningful and fulfilled lives.
One last question, Sansara, and we have to do it in about a minute and a half. I mentioned before that you're a fierce advocate for the emancipation of women. Actually, what I should have said even more is you're a fierce advocate for the emancipation of all humanity, and that's what drives a lot of what you're doing. And I'd like to ask to end on this, the link between fighting for the morality of abortion, for fighting for the right to have an abortion, defending it and extending it. What's the link between that and your goal of emancipating humanity?
Okay, in 1 minute. I'll refer listeners to, there's a great article this week in Revolution newspaper at revcom.us. It's the morality of abortion and the immorality of those who oppose it. And that's a really good resource for people, and it expands further than I'm able to. But when we make revolution, day one, we are going to guarantee in a socialist republic, this is written in the Constitution that RCP just produced, we're going to guarantee women the right to abortion. We're going to guarantee the right to reproductive freedom. And the link is that ever since you've had class society, ever since you've had class-divided societies, you've had women's reproduction, and this is very compressed, but you've had it controlled because it is at heart about property lines. Who's going to inherit what social position, what class position, and what property from one generation to the next? And if you do not control women's reproduction, then the whole thing unravels. So women's liberation is central to liberating all of humanity if you want to deal with any form of oppression, and from reverse, if you want to deal with any other form of oppression, be it racism, national oppression, imperialism, other class divides, or class divisions in general. You can't liberate anybody unless you also liberate women, and they're bound together. So
we have to wrap up on that note, Sansara. Thank you very much on that.
Thank you,
all right,
Mike.
Sunny. Thanks a lot. Talk to you later. And I also want to remind listeners that if you want to read the Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity that was put out by the Revolutionary Communist Party, you can get that at revcom.us. All right, now we have a very special segment of the program, one that this has never been played before, and I want people to listen to it. It's something that you wouldn't quite expect, but maybe you should. It's a spoken word piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So take a listen, and I'll be back after this.
All played out. We must broadly unite to carry out the fight to resist the crimes of this system. But on the real revolution is the only solution. So we need to call out things whose time has run out, which keep people in chains, suffering unbearable pain. These things are all played out. Capitalist vultures, big time and worldwide exploiters, preaching about personal responsibility, ranting about predators and criminality, terrorizing the youth in the inner cities, while you loot everywhere you see, slaughter people and rain destruction through crimes untold, all to enforce your rule and amass your gold on the backs of billions, chaining them in slavery new and old. Your time in history, it's gone. It's
all played out.
This puffed up stuff about the land of the free and the home of the brave, a country that built itself on bodies of slaves and ruthless genocidal robbery, that spreads its empire through plunder, driving countless people under with its bloody red, white, and blue rag unfurled. All this pompous nonsense about the leader of the free world, that's
all played out.
Vicious politicians and mindless mobs, screaming and threatening, hounding people driven from their homelands, growling and howling, speak English or go home. These fools aren't saying anything worthwhile in any tongue. It's the same old song they've always sung. Fade deeper in the shadows, suffer in silence while you slave. To create wealth we crave. It's our way, backed up by violence. This garbage is
all played out.
People of privilege demanding their right to be a parasite, whining about how things aren't good like they used to be. Back in the day, when things were done in an even worse way. Look you in the face, say it's not about race or keeping half of humanity down, but want you in your place if you're a woman or black or brown. What this is,
it's all played out.
Nigger, a homicidal epithet from days of slave ship nightmare, plantation overseers with whips, lynch mobs, racist whites on power trips, repeated still now by far too many, openly racist or hyped as hip and cool, frat boys blasting rap. Who do they think they fool? Nigger, a word that bites deeper than a frothing, rabid beast, that shouts the horror of centuries, cruelty and brutality, a word nobody should want to use, a word that just can't be made good, even if a shout-out to homies in the hood. This word and everything it stands for, it's long past time it be
all played out.
Modern-day Uncle Toms, respectable Negroes who squawk out poison, parrot lies of powers that be, package slander is the truth, never fail to blame the youth, even slam them as our worst enemy. Oh, you bootlicking, wannabe, second-class bourgeoisie, you're
all played out.
Reverends and the rest, not ones who really stand with the oppressed, but those who strut and preach to keep the people down, on their knees, suffering indignities, who put the blame on those unfree for ways that they are kept in misery. Pompous, self-righteous asses who breathe contempt for the masses. Fools who worship the powers that be, insisting that things stay locked within the bounds of bargains with the bourgeoisie.
All played out!
Backward-ass athletes and entertainers wearing a cross, slavish symbol of submission, never making it their mission to use their position to help people rise up. Never raise a fist, but point a foolish finger to the sky, giving praise, helping to spread the lie that in this system you can make it if you try. So if you're poor and beaten down, it's you to blame. Never demanding to know why, if some supposed God controls all this, so many suffer needlessly. Shame should be on such a God if it existed, but all this God talk is just twisted. It's all in God's hands. Leave it to the Lord. Just helps this system stay in power when bowing down to lords and masters should be over. All this, too, it's
all played out.
Falling for that game, caught up in those lies about Obama, how he's bringing peace and something really new. When he does the same as done before, still using torture, no better than John Yoo and that whole crew, waging unjust wars that never cease. You look the other way, time after time, day after day, at all the crimes against humanity under Obama's command and with his decree. He talks about getting beyond race. His is just a different face that covers all too familiar murder and brutality by sneering pigs who hunt down youth in inner cities. You should know this game is
all played out.
Elections where if you're looking for a better world, no matter how you choose, yes, P.S., you lose. You're always left deflated and frustrated because the politicians and elections are cogs in a machine, part of a system that runs and rules by treating human beings and the earth as things to be exploited and despoiled. Believing the hype, putting all your faith in this bourgeois democracy, this lie of people's sovereignty, come on, it's
all played out.
Placing your hand over your heart, honoring the rag of U.S. imperialism, doing your part to prove you are respectable, will do only what's acceptable. Pledging allegiance to this flag, bowing down to this monstrosity that causes so much horror for humanity.
All played out!
I got my mind on my money and my money on my mind. That craziness about being like Scarface, acting without a trace of humanity, plundering and violating without remorse, killing and dying for no good purpose. Give it up! It's
all played out!
Men thinking it's their right to order women around and misuse them, to degrade and abuse them, talking all that talk about bitches and hoes, and if she's pregnant, she can't have an abortion because she should have kept her legs closed. Assertion of manhood or talk of protecting womanhood, which still means keeping women subordinated and dominated. All this garbage about women being less than man, less than fully human, that's
all played out.
Disrespecting people who love someone of the same sex, treating them as objects of contempt, dogging them, beating them down for being different. Religious tradition encoding oppression, authority invoked to enforce suppression of sexuality in forms that are outside the norms that are proclaimed natural and God-ordained. Norms that in reality enforce exploitation, perpetuate patriarchy and male domination. All this too is
all played out.
Shop until you drop. Buy, buy, buy. You are what you own. Your worth is what you purchase. I. Throngs gathering to scramble for the latest iToy rage, but not to resist injustice and endless outrage.
All played out.
Tabloid addiction and gossip slinging, treating as prominent what is really trivial, making what really matters seem invisible, acting like mobs in Roman arena, sneering and snarking with a vicious demeanor, building yourself up by tearing other people down.
All played out.
Putting up with all this madness, even though you know it's wrong, being passive, thinking how they want you thinking, acting just to get along, singing that old song, that though the crimes are terrible and massive, nothing can be done about this, nothing can change, because of human nature, things are bound to be this way. Revolution, that was tried and it failed. Communism, voice dissent and they'll haul you off to jail. With communism, they take away your freedom. We say that's just wrong, plus there's a new synthesis. There are speeches, books with deep analysis, but you don't read them, won't hear them, or go near them. You remain in paralysis. Like that, you're
all played out.
A so-called left that, to tell the truth, finds it frightening and distasteful to change the world radically at its root. Disgraceful. A left that is content with posing, devoid of rage or joy, its passion spent. Deceiving mimic. Miming what it claims to be opposing, rejects the path of revolution, insists there can be only one solution that is viable and desirable, reform within the confines of this system, change conforming to the dictates of this brutal order, talks forever of democracy, cover for dictatorship of bourgeoisie, politics of identity that really comes back down to me. If it speaks of socialism, it is tired out, dried up dogma, no reality, lacking fire, ferment, and conviction, impoverished imagination, lowered vision. The change it talks about is paltry fiction, lifeless, desiccated, can't lead anyone to be emancipated. A left like that is
all played out.
This whole damn system, root and source of all this madness,
all played out.
Rupture, advance, beyond all that, no doubt. Putting an end to this insanity, working for revolution to emancipate all humanity. That's what we got to be all about. All the rest that poses and opposes what cries out to be done, it needs to be over and gone. It's
all played out.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with his piece, All Played Out. Now, listen, I want people, that was the first time that that was broadcast anywhere ever, okay? And I want people to actually, you've listened to it, I'd really appreciate hearing what you think about it. So write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. That's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you like it, spread the word. Turn people onto the piece and spread it everywhere. Maybe we can help poke a hole in all the terrible fog that people, so many people, too many people, in fact, seem to be wandering around in these days. This piece, All Played Out by Bob Avakian, is posted online now, and you can find the address for it by going to revcom.us. You'll find the address there, plus a lot of other ideas on how to spread it, and also suggestions about where you can post your thoughts on it and reviews of it. So check that out at revcom.us, and then go to the site and download All Played Out by Bob Avakian. You know, our theme of today's show has been around abortion, sexuality, and the liberation of women. Abortion, the morality of abortion, the morality of the right to abortion, and the immorality of those who oppose it. And I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. And these are from a Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity put out by the Revolutionary Communist Party. And again, you can get that at revcom.us. So check this out. Imagine if abortion and birth control were available to all women at all times without stigma or apology. Imagine if everyone learned the science surrounding women's biology, as well as science and the scientific method more broadly, so that never again could so-called holy men prey on people's ignorance and heap the weight of tradition, the shackles of forced motherhood, and the suffocation of shame on women for exercising these most fundamental rights. It's not just a dream. It is possible, and it is urgently crying out to be done. Again, that's from a Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity, which you'll find at revcom.us. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer of the show. If you want to holler about the show, holler at me by writing to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. I want to thank my engineer today, Tamika, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. I want to thank my guest, Carol Jaffe, the author of Dispatches from the Abortion Wars and The Cost of Fanaticism, The Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us, Jessica Ahrens, and Sansara Taylor, who you can read her work at sansara.blogspot.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a song that I found in my back pocket. I didn't know it was there, but apparently it's been there for quite some time. It's a song that I really, really love. It's one that I had completely forgotten about, and I think you'll really like it too, and I think it actually fits in well with the theme of today's show. It's Something in the Air by Thunderclap Newman. So until next week, enjoy.